Welcome to Radio Survivor. We are here for the love of radio and sound. It is my pleasure to welcome to our airwaves my friend in radio, Mitch Jezerich. Mitch, thanks for coming today.
It's my very good pleasure, Eric, to be here. It's been a very long time, sir.
Yeah.
For full disclosure, because I think you shouldn't keep this from your listeners, Eric. We've been friends for a long, long time, and we first met back at KPFA. What would we say? Maybe what was it? 15 years ago? 14 years ago? Somewhere around then?
Yes. Well, I'm happy to tell the listeners that one of the reasons I'm having you on the show today is to look backwards at our time together in radio at Pacifica Radio Station KPFA. We first met around the beginning of the Iraq War, maybe 3 months into the beginning of the Iraq War. So in the middle of 2003, but we were internet co-workers in 2003, back before that became the default reality for all desk workers. You and I were connected to one another over the telephones and the internet, producing a news program together.
Free Speech Radio News.
This is
when I was in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. So we first
You were met, in Berkeley.
We first met when you, Ms. Jezerich, were the Washington, D.C. Capital Correspondent for Free Speech Radio News, which is a beautiful place to start today's episode because I love to tell people about Free Speech Radio News.
And it's really fascinating. As you were in Berkeley, you were a tech producer, if I recall correctly. You were helping put the show together. And that was no easy task because nobody was in the same place with this newscast. I was involved every morning in the editorial calls, and we'd have people in Los Angeles. The main producer was in Los Angeles. The host would be in New York, or I would be in D.C. Nobody. The tech team was in Berkeley. That's where you were. Nobody was in the same place. And yet we were able to, and we had reporters all over the world, and yet we were still able to pull off this newscast 5 days a week. And I know I was especially difficult on the tech team because I was the one person with a daily deadline, and my deadline was kind of early, and I had to go get all the sound I needed for a story and put it together by 1 o'clock your time.
That's right. Yeah, way too early for a Washington, D.C. The news cycle in D.C. was kind of in the middle by the time your first deadline to file. So you were late for the morning and way too early for the evening news cycle.
So yeah, I have an excuse, but nonetheless, I know.
That's great.
I drove our previous engineer before you out because of it.
I can speak on behalf of my coworker at the tech team of Free Speech Radio News in Berkeley, who founded the tech team, who built it up from scratch and was an incredible brain, a person who I won't name out loud because I haven't gotten their permission to name them, but I will because as a leader in my life, as an example of how to be a professional in radio, they really set a bar. And there was two individuals who trained me on the Free Speech Radio News tech team and then allowed me to begin working at first as a volunteer, like we all do, right? We start as volunteers in community radio, and then eventually, if we're extremely lucky, we start gathering paid shifts into our little workday in order to do the work of making radio. And yeah, the tech team was always under pressure because the day would begin kind of late in the morning, like around 10 a.m., and the show, a half-an-hour news magazine with a host reading introductions to stories that are each about 4 minutes long that are being emailed in through the audio over the web, which was not impossible in 2003, but still kind of unique. The idea of sending large audio files over the internet had not yet been you know, what industrialized the way it is these days. You know, everybody can send a big audio file now. There weren't even USB connections to get the audio onto computers. So every producer across the globe, right? We had producers sending their audio from Africa, from India, from the Middle East, and Mitch, you were sending yours from the U.S. Capitol. How did you get your audio onto a computer in 2003?
Well, this much the same way I do now. You know, you're able to record on a computer. I would have a recorder, a mini disc recorder at the time, which was used. And then to put that sound on the computer, I have to connect through analog wires to the computer. And I would play what I wanted to put on the computer in real time. And then I would do the same thing with my voice track. So actually, I might have just recorded straight onto the computer, not onto my mini disc player. But once I got everything onto the computer, it was really not a whole lot different than it is now. In fact, I even started using the same audio editing program that I still use today. At the time, it was called Cool Edit.
Yeah.
But now it's Adobe Audition. But it's fundamentally the same.
Okay. I love this. I do want to get deep into the radio nostalgia weeds as people who create things with technology. But I went off on a tangent. Let's go back to I wanted to ask you a question, a big question, Mitch. I wonder what do you think the reason is to be on the radio? Why do we make radio?
Well, I think there are probably a million answers to that question, right? And probably everyone has their own sense of why to be on the radio. But in the most simple term, radio is a media outlet and gives the ability of a person or people to be able to speak to a mass of people. And I think that fundamentally is what, and you could do that for entertainment. You could do it for news. You could do it for music. You can, you know, in other words, it's another stage. Everything we used to do on a stage suddenly was put on radio, perhaps not the news, but so with the radio, and of course, radio would lead eventually to TV, but radio was first. But I think fundamentally they both accomplish the same thing, the ability to communicate, to be on it. There's a reason to watch it or listen to it, and there's a reason to be on it.
Yeah.
And I suspect the reason to be on it is to be able to, one thing that everyone would probably agree to is to be able to broadcast, getting to the original version of the word broadcasting, which means to disseminate seeds, is to be able to, you know, disseminate information as widely as possible.
And Mitch, you had a real privilege in the beginning years that we started off today's episode talking about, in this time where you were the Capitol Hill correspondent for Free Speech Radio News, which was more or less a show on the Pacifica radio airwaves, you know, in Berkeley, in Texas, in New York City, and Free Speech Radio News actually kind of probably was one of the most widely distributed Pacifica radio programs in its time. I know that it aired here in Portland, Oregon, back in 2004. It was one of the only Pacifica shows that aired on the KBOO in Portland, Oregon, which is not a Pacifica radio station. It aired everywhere. I would hear my voice coming out of airwaves all over the place, weirdly. Okay, but you're the Capitol Hill correspondent in the early 2000s. How long did you work for Free Speech Radio News on Capitol Hill?
2003 to 2006.
It seems like so much longer in my memory. Those were very important years. One of the reasons we are speaking today is because those were important years in the so-called war on terror, as we used to call it, the so-called war on terror. It was the moment when the Iraq war began.
No. 2003 was the year that the Iraq War began. You were right about that. I actually got to Washington, D.C. a few months after the war had begun. The war had begun, I believe, in March, the middle of March, yeah. And I got to D.C. in August. But I will say, since, and I'm sure this is not going to air on the same day that we're talking, but we are talking on the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And I would say that my reporting career, especially the beginning of it, and my foundational years was covering the war on terrorism. Even before I got to Washington, D.C. on the day of 9/11/2001, I was a volunteer reporter at KPFA, and I went in to report that day, which is, you know, a day I'll never forget. And then, of course, from that day on, the war on terrorism was the dominant story that I covered and that most news outlets were covering. All the way up, I would say, until about maybe 2006 or so. And then I think this fatigue, the war still, you know, went on. There is no question about that. But there was this public fatigue that people were having about the war. And I think over the years, less and less, everyone was paying attention to the war. Yeah. But the foundational years for me were definitely from 2001, really starting at 9/11, because that changed everything.
Right.
From 9/11, probably through that next decade, the war on terrorism was the most important story, at least in my life and in my career.
And you mentioned a moment ago how we broadcast, we take the stage, as it were, to share voices with the listeners, and it's I think that. I hope that on community radio, people approach that work with more gratitude and humility, hopefully, than they tend to in the so-called corporate media, in places where maybe it seems more of a like they're the ones who you should be proud to listen to them. It seems sometimes the other side of the coin. So okay, we're on the airwaves. And we have this privilege to be here. And then we're talking now about a moment when, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the 2001, September 11th, 2001, where, as we used to say on the radio, the war drums are beating very loudly. It's pretty much the dominant narrative of its time, especially on the airwaves of commercial news media. The march to war is sort of unstoppable at that point. And yet, Mitch, at that time, you're volunteering at a radio station in Berkeley, California, which was founded by pacifists in the aftermath of World War II and has been on the air as a non-commercial radio station. It built the model in so many ways of listener-sponsored radio coming out of, and this is Pacifica Radio, KPFA in Berkeley. Yeah, it is listener-sponsored in the post-war period as an alternative voice for peace, as it were. And here we are 50 years later on September 11, 2001. Like, tell me about that time of making radio.
I feel like, and first to acknowledge, and I think we're seeing this on the anniversary of 9/11, that remembering that a lot of people died on that day, and a lot of families were put into turmoil on that day, and a lot of kids grew up without their parents because of that day, and the shock, and we all remember that shock, Eric, when 9/11 happened. Everyone knows where they were, and I remember the entire day vividly of that day, and which is to me pretty remarkable. But it's like, you know, growing up, I always heard everyone knew exactly what they were doing when they heard about the assassination of JFK, or when people landed on the moon. Everyone knew exactly where they were, but that was before my time. Well, what happened on 9/11 was our time, right? And that will be a day I will never forget. And I don't want to downplay the tragedies that happened. And in saying all that, I actually believe the war on terror years are probably, in my opinion, the golden years of KPFA, the station that I worked at. And the reason I say that, and everyone has their own idea of, you know, what the golden, but everyone has their own ideas of what KPFA is. So I'm sure other people have their other ideas of KPFA, including KPFA's role during the communist witch hunts of the 50s and early 60s, et cetera, et cetera. But for my time, KPFA was the only radio station. And this is, the internet exists, as you just explained, Eric. We were all putting a newscast together over the internet. But most people weren't getting their news from the internet yet. And it's still the same handful of television cable companies, a handful of radio stations, and a handful of newspapers that are forming the framework of how the public sees things and perceives things and reacts to them. And that was very much happening on September 11th and in the few years past September 11th, 2001. And KPFA was one of the very few, you can't say only, but maybe even in broadcasting. Well, I say KPFA, I should say Pacifica at large. When I say Pacifica at large, I also include sort of affiliates to Pacifica, other community radio stations out there. I think we're also a part of this trend that KPFA was doing, but was really the only place on the radio that you could hear dissidents speaking about what was happening here in this country in our march, not just our march to war in Afghanistan, but also what was happening on the domestic front with the FBI ramping up its surveillance, especially of Muslim American communities here. And KPFA, when I say KPFA, again, I mean it for kind of the larger community radio world, KPFA was the one place where you would hear dissent, where you would hear questioning about who would talk about, we should understand why we got hit in the first place and the role the United States has played in the world that would create such animosity towards people to want to strike the United States. And it wasn't to defend the strike, but it was to try to put it in context. This is a period of time after the fall of the Soviet Union, when the United States becomes the sole superpower in the world and is wielding its power in however it feels fit, including its power in the Middle East, especially over resources like oil. And we were supporting really repressive, terrible regimes. And this caused a lot of animosity towards the United States. And we should understand this. And KPFA was the one place that you would get it. And if I could just tell you a story quickly, but it's a little bit long, but I believe we have some time. So give me a little space here, because I actually want to back up 6 months before 9/11 happened. But I'm going to talk about what happened to me on 9/11 that day. But 6 months before, I was a volunteer reporter for KPFA. And I went down to Mexico because the Zapatistas, Liberation Army, Indigenous Army from Chiapas, Mexico, were actually coming out of Chiapas. They had their uprising in 1994. And in 2003, end of February, beginning of March, they began a long caravan leaving Chiapas and traveling all through southern Mexico on a caravan that was going to get to Mexico City, the country's capital, to get to the Zócalo, where the Capitol building is. And I went on that march with them, and I covered it for KPFA. And it was on March 11th that they arrived to the Zócalo. 1 million people showed up. And this was really an amazing moment, because I lived in Mexico during the 1990s. And the Zapatistas were around. They started their uprising in 1994. But there was a lot of negativity in Mexico towards the Zapatistas in the 1990s. I did not live in Chiapas. I lived in about 100 miles north of Mexico City in a city in a state called Querétaro. But I was fascinated by the Zapatistas. But just to give you an example, I was a foreign exchange student. And when I got to Mexico, I brought with me my subcomandante Marco shirt. And when I would wear that to class, people got angry with me, right? And there was a lot of racism and negativity towards the indigenous population. When I went back to cover this march in 2003, this march kind of flipped the nation's imagination, both about the Zapatistas, but also about what it meant to be indigenous, and you know, most Mexicans are also indigenous, and people were suddenly, you know, connecting to their roots in this way, and it was a very beautiful thing. And so a million people show up to the Zócalo in Mexico City on March 11th, and I get all of this recording. I have a ton of tape on my mini disc, and then the way I'm actually getting these stories back to KPFA is I'm finding a telephone booth. I get in the telephone booth. I make a collect call to Mark Miracle over at the KPFA news department. And then I take a headphone. I was actually able to produce my story and create clips in a very ingenious way on the mini disc player itself. And the way I was able to do that is I had a friend with me, Kirk Martin, who's Matt Martin's brother, a longtime radio producer here in the Bay Area. Kirk Martin also had a mini disc player, and we connect our mini disc players through a mini to mini wire so that we could exchange sound. And I was able to actually create a new story on a mini disc player by itself. And then the way I would get this story to Mark Miracle is I would wrap the telephone receiver to a headphone and turn up the headphone as loud as I could. And then Mark and I would play it in real time, and Mark would record it. And that's how I got him those stories.
And Mark would record it to analog
on a reel
tape.
To reel tape. Yeah. This was all to get it onto a reel to reel tape. And that's another part of the story is KPFA always a little bit behind the curve when it comes ahead of the curve when it comes to
content,
you know, when it comes to, you know, in a just world, a little behind the curve when it comes to technology.
It costs a lot of money in the year 2000 to convert your entire analog radio production, you know, that you've invested decades in. It costs a lot of money to switch. And
it's hard to train
people. And anyway.
That's fair. That's fair. No, that's absolutely fair. But we're still behind the curve. Okay. Yeah. And up to this point, in learning radio and when I'm at the station, I learned how to edit using the old way on reel to reel tape. Yeah. I remember using an actual
cutting tape,
razor blade, and you know, sticky tape to put it back together and everything. And I always told myself that I'm glad I'm learning this now, because when I'm older and I want to come back to the archive, I'll know how to access it.
Well,
and of course, 20 years later, and I never have.
I want to say though also is that because I did not cut tape as a radio producer, but I did have the opportunity to cut film, to make one student film with very cheaply in college. But I noticed right away, because I'd had my hands on digital tools as an amateur filmmaker in high school, and then when I was cutting the physical tape a few years later, I realized that there was a real value in having a clip and seeing it physically, pinning it to the wall and knowing that's my clip and I'm going to use it. And I think that having that opportunity to build, I'm wondering if you think that having that opportunity to learn how to build your radio stories, Mitch, by physically clipping the sound bite out and knowing how long it was in inches, how that helped you as a digital radio producer?
Well, I never taped it to the wall. So I actually never saw the length of a particular clip, but I will tell you what happened. I am a lifelong wheelchair user, and I push my chair. I have a manual chair. And what would happen with discarded tape, it was more of an issue with discarded tape. And you had a lot of discarded tape. And we did it the Mark Miracle way. You just threw that to the ground when you didn't need it because you're on deadline and you need to get this done as soon as you possibly
can.
The
cutting room floor, kids.
And so the whole floor would just be full of tape. And every day after I was done filing my story, I'd have to go in another room, get out of my chair, and painstakingly take out all the tape that had got into my wheels, especially the smaller front wheels of my wheelchair, because it got all tangled up in there. And it would sometimes be a difficult task to be able to do all that. So why are we talking about this when I started talking about 9/11? Well, the connection here is, again, the Zapatistas arrive to the Zócalo, which is this historic moment, on March 11th. Then I come home and I have everything that I played up to that point was received from the telephone, even though I actually had in-person sound. You know, it was all heard on the telephone because that's how I was getting my stories to Mark Miracle. So when I came home, I was like, I have all this sound. I want to make a documentary. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to learn how to do digital editing on a computer, which I had never done before that point. And I'm going to take time and I'm going to learn how to do that. And I'm going to make this documentary that way. And of course, that took a little while to do. And so I was trying to think of a peg of, well, when can I finish this documentary? And the morning show at the time at KPFA had agreed to play it. And I thought about it. I'm like, oh, what about on September 11th? That will be the 6-month anniversary of the Zapatistas arriving in the Zocalo. That seems appropriate to me. Let's do that. So Lisa Rothman, who is the executive producer of the KPFA morning show at the time, gives me the go-ahead, says that they'll air it on that day, and I start working on it. September 10th comes around. I'm almost done. I really took a few months to work on it. I needed, so much of it was in Spanish, and I needed people to be able to read English over it. I remember I had the great Wendell Harper, who had the great Wendell Harper voice, reading the parts of Subcomandante Marcos, which was pretty awesome. And, you know, so I finally put it all together and I'm finishing it up on September 10th and it's late night and I'm trying to beat my BART curfew because the last BART train heading to Oakland comes at midnight. And I'm sitting in the room. And of course, because KPFA is behind the curve, I've produced this digital documentary, audio digital documentary to be played on the air, but KPFA has no capacity to be able to play a digital file on the air. So I had to record it back to analog so that they could so that they could play it on reel.
That was
reel.
Before the burning a CD moment. That's amazing.
It could have been. That was, you know, it was such a long time ago. It wasn't an option.
I'm sure it was a transitional moment. I mean, I worked at KPFA near around this time, and it was like one computer in one office had the power to burn a CD, but you didn't want to have to try to burn a CD anywhere else in the building because you couldn't depend on that computer to have a reliable CD burner at the time. So yeah. And then you're also referring to a time, just in case there are young people listening, computers in an office were not necessarily networked to one another at this time. They were really isolated workspaces that whose hard drives were closed.
That's right. And it's very unclear if the engineer and the people that are working in the morning would even be comfortable with a different format. Right.
And I do want to jump in and just say that only a few years later, KPFA fully embraced networked computers and digital audio files, so much so that it would you wouldn't even notice coming into the building as I did in 2003, which is only 3 years, 2.5 years after your narrative. Everything was networked. Everything worked really well.
I think you all had a lot to do that, and the team at Free Speech Radio News. Right. I actually think had a lot of, because again, as we were talking earlier, that's where the tech team was located, and I think you all had a big role.
Yeah, we were
in making that happen
because of our job of putting together this half hour, 29-minute daily radio show and pushing it out to the network, which went out on a satellite feed as well as went out on the internet and needed. You know, we were using the tech team was two people and their computers had to be networked and we were feeding our show into a studio off a computer and we didn't have time to do it any other way. So because of the tension of Free Speech Radio News's daily tasks, which were important, which weren't just about our own ego, it was about getting this news program out to the entire network, we were able to lean on KPFA's incredible engineering staff, which at the time was computer professionals who were full-time coding, as well as audio engineers who were capable of networking machines and coming up with solutions. So yeah, the community, the professional community at KPFA really pushed the technical envelope very quickly. But Mitch,
let me go back to where I was. I don't want to stop the story before we even get to the good part.
Yeah.
I recognize it's a long one, but you asked for 90 minutes, so I'm giving it to you. So I have to record my 20-minute documentary onto reel-to-reel tape so that they could play it the next morning, which was going to be September 11th. And it's September 10th. It gets about 11 o'clock. I still have a few minutes before I got to worry about my train. And I'm in the new studio room with Kelia Ramirez, the late, great Kelia Ramirez.
Yeah, my good
who
friend.
Was a main staple at KPFA for many years in the news department. And she's helping me. She's assisting me record it to reel to reel. And when the 20, and we had to do it real time, obviously. And when the when it was over, she's sitting there listening to the whole thing. She looks at me and she just says, "That was genius."
Oh.
And of course, I believed her. Now, there's a lot of things in the past I thought were genius at the time and remembered as being genius. And I've since gone back and heard some of it. And I'm like, and I cringe. I'm like, oh my God, that was not genius. It was something, but it was not that. And that it's very possible that's what this is too. Regrettably, I've actually lost the documentary. But that's what she said. And I believed her at the time because I put a lot of work in it. And yeah. I thought so too.
And I want to say that I'm going, you know, Kelia Ramirez pick was one of those individuals at the KPFA, in the KPFA building, who picked up paid shifts and worked as a paid worker, but also volunteered countless hours. And the ratio would probably fluctuate wildly based on my own experience as being one of those individuals. And I'm going to assume that at this moment, Kelia Ramirez is at work. It's 11 o'clock. And she is there helping you, Mitch Jezerich, the young radio producer, finish your documentary for the love of getting these voices from the Zocalo in Mexico City out to the Northern California radio audience, not for a paycheck, but because she believed it was valuable and helping you was fun.
I think that's right. I think that's right. Kelia Ramirez was a real real mensch, a real great human being.
Yeah.
And so much so, so dedicated. So, I mean, she had a couple of heart attacks. The second one would take her out. The first one she had while she was engineering the news department.
Oh, my God.
Which almost seems fitting, actually, in many ways. And so that happens with her. And now I'm going to BART because I need to get on the last BART train. I remember coming out of the elevator at Berkeley BART onto the platform. I remember this visually, coming out of it and thinking to myself, because I thought I just had produced something great. And I'm coming out of the BART elevator and I'm thinking to myself, tomorrow my life's going to change. Tomorrow the things are not going to be the same. So I get home. I set my alarm for 7:08 in the morning because that's the exact minute that my documentary is supposed to start to be playing. It was one of those clock radios and I wanted to wake up to the drums that begin the documentary. I wanted to wake up to that. So I go to sleep and the alarm goes off and it's not my documentary I hear at first. Instead, I hear Larry Bensky's voice, who's not even a host of that program, but I'm just waking up. I mean, at that very same moment that the alarm goes off, my phone starts ringing. So I'm like, well, let me go answer this phone. I'm sure it's somebody calling to congratulate me. Right? You're not thinking clearly at that moment, you know? And I pick up the phone. I'm like, hello. And I hear this woman's voice on the other end screaming at me. I'm not going to work today. I'm staying home right here. And I'm going to die with my kids. And I'm like, who is this? You know, again, I don't know what's going on. I'm just like, what? And she's like, and it was my coworker because I was a volunteer reporter at KPFA. I worked somewhere else at the time. And she's like, turn on the TV. And I turn on the TV and I see a single tower of the World Trade Center standing. The other one had already collapsed. And the one that was still up was, you know, smoldering in smoke. And then, of course, I realized, yeah, they're not playing my documentary on the air. Larry Bensky's there, who was really the national affairs correspondent for the network. He's the guy that would come in such a moment to start to provide analysis and to interview people and to do coverage. And I was just in shock. And I lived, and I still do, I lived in Oakland. I had an apartment that oversaw downtown. I'm looking out my window. I'm wondering, man, why is I'm in shock? I'm like, wow, am I in danger? I think everyone thought this at the time. Right? Am I in danger where I am? Is something going to happen here in the downtown area? And so I'm just sitting there and I'm watching it for a long time. And then suddenly And just again, sort of just to, this is sort of, I'm going to get into why I think KPFA was so important in these years. I'm stuck with the question is, do I go into work or do I go to the radio station and help out there? They may need it. And of course, there was no question. I was going to go to the radio station. This was before eventually the work said, hey, don't come in. No one's coming in. But this was before that even happened. I had already decided, well, sorry, work. I'm going to KPFA. And I take Bart back to Berkeley and I get on the train. And it's really wild because whenever you get on the train at that hour going away from San Francisco, it's usually empty, right? Because everyone's going towards San Francisco that hour. But this train was packed with people going away from San Francisco, packed with people who were just leaving the city. Again, no one, I was worried about downtown Oakland. Never mind. Imagine what it would have been like being in downtown San Francisco on this day.
Yeah. And I would like to mention that if you turned on cable news at the moment that the 9/11 attacks were happening, that was the message. Who knows what's happening next? It seemed like a cascade of escalating violent catastrophes that could hit anywhere at any time, because it wasn't just New York City. It was other points on the map that certainly get less attention now, and sort of just like a cloud of threat and potential.
Well, Eric, there were a ton of rumors at the time.
Yeah.
And that was actually my first assignment to follow up on. So I'm on this train coming into Berkeley and it's packed and everyone's looking at each other. You know, when you're on a BART train or a subway train, no one looks at each other, right? People are looking at each other and not saying anything. And everyone had this look on their face of like, what the hell is happening? And so I get to the radio station, I walk in, and I see Mark Maracle and Eileen Alfandary, and everyone's there now. I'm like, hey, I'm here to help in anything you need. And Mark says, and puts my very first story is to follow up on all these rumors that we are hearing about having been hit. And you can understand, I mean, rumors fly anyways. And this is a good lesson to understand when you are covering something that first happens. Most people end up getting the story wrong in the first few hours. In fact, even before I came on to join you, I was watching some CNN and CBS coverage of when the towers were first struck. And their speculation was wildly off of what was happening. And so I get into the radio station. We're hearing rumors that the Lawrence Livermore lab had been hit in California.
Yeah, which is a nuclear facility. Yeah.
And so my first assignment is to follow up on all these rumors. I had to call the Lawrence Livermore lab to see if anything had happened there. And nothing had happened in California, right? Well, at least not that way. Some things did happen in California, which I'll get to next. So anyways, I get finished following up on all these rumors. None of them were true.
Yeah. And that was just a few hours of work as a reporter.
That I was done with that within an hour or two, okay. You know. And then my next assignment comes. And this would be a pivotal moment, I feel like, in my life. I go to Mark Maracle. I'm like, what else do you need? And he's like, we want you to monitor and follow up and report on any potential hate crimes or backlash against Muslims or people who appear to be Muslims. Whenever I think back on that, that was really profound, because at the moment, everyone was asking, why do they hate us? And you know, there was some reason for that. And, you know, and we're so connected to their own trauma and the trauma that happened to the country. I don't think there was anyone else, and I could be wrong on this. There may be examples. I'm happy to be wrong if so. But I don't think if there were others, there weren't many who were worried about particular communities that were now vulnerable
Especially
because of all this.
Especially in newsrooms. In newsrooms with large broadcast reaches, you know, and it just to say it, like, Mark Maracle is a white man, and so for the white news director of a professional and volunteer run newsroom to recognize in the first hours of the crisis, how are Muslim communities and Muslim,
that was the first thing that came to our mind.
Yeah.
I'm a white man too. And that was the first thing that we thought about that was important for us
because,
to cover.
Because we had seen, if you'd been paying attention with a social justice framework in the past, we have already seen before 2001, September 11th, that if there were terrorist attacks or perceived terrorist attacks on target, that hate crimes in the United States would go up. This is already a pattern that we could expect. And if you were paying attention to it, it would be no surprise that this event would be worse.
And just imagine, to watch what was happening on 9/11 was traumatic for everyone. Everyone, no matter what religion, no matter what color you were, it was traumatic. It was traumatic for me to watch it. I was in shock. But then what I could not imagine, and what did not happen to me personally, is then imagining suddenly everyone in the country looking at you and people like you and anger starting to be directed towards you for something like that happening. And that is exactly what happened on that day. I talked to the Muslim Peace Center in San Jose who had their windows broken. Might be worth double checking that part. I kind of wonder myself, did they really have their windows broken, or am I mixing it up because somebody else had their windows broken? I actually don't. I think they had their windows broken, but I'm just putting this out there that that could be off a little bit.
Yeah.
But their voicemail was full of hatred and some of the most disgusting thing. And they plugged me into their voicemail. I don't know how they did it, but I got a clear recording of their voicemail. And it was one message after another of men, I only heard men, screaming at the top of their lungs how they wanted them to die, how they hated them, how this was their fault. I mean, imagine the shock of 9/11 was shocking, but imagine that, and then this follows up, and you're having all this anger directed towards you. And so I recorded it, and we recorded it, and it was full of expletives, and we put it on air as it was. Even though we might have gotten in trouble by the FCC for expletives going out on the air. And we played it several times on the air with the purpose of saying, this isn't cool. This isn't okay. This is a problem. And to me, that's when I realized this, I want to work with KPFA. I want to be here because that was the right thing to do. I think now it might seem obvious it was the right thing to do, but it wasn't so obvious. I think it was obvious for us, but it wasn't so universally accepted that was the right thing to do back in 2001.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I think that from my experience of being someone who consumed media prior to coming to KPFA in the middle of the early 2000s, and then someone who helped produce media from inside of a radio station with that kind of editorial perspective of always trying to seek out the story that would help, you know, shed light on the situation, as opposed to, you know, whipping up, you know, beating war drums or making the situation worse for vulnerable people. And then I happened to work at my desk at KPFA during the years that Twitter and Facebook come into the world, and I'm going to focus more on Twitter than Facebook. And I genuinely believe that an argument can be made that Twitter pushed. It's like that there was something about Twitter that pushed everything over into the kind of framework that we're talking about, where we consider, you know, how it centered new voices, you know, and a lot of people of color and Muslim voices as well. Like, there was a way in which Twitter opened up the world of mainstream storytelling. You know, lots of terrible things have been posted and disseminated on that website as well, including a particular presidential candidate and then leader of the free world.
It made a lot of things possible that weren't possible before Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Black Lives Matter movement
absolutely
is very much a Twitter. And, you know, and at the time, immediately, you know, there was a moment maybe one of Twitter's greatest moments in a weird way, and a different topic for another story, was the Egyptian spring seemed to be very much a Twitter-based.
Absolutely. No. Social media changed how we get information.
It's gone dark.
The years we're talking about.
Yeah. Hmm? I'm just saying.
The years we're talking about is before.
Yeah, exactly.
This is before we have that. And that's what made KPFA so special. And so that's my story on 9/11, but it didn't stop on 9/11. Those were the kind of stories that we were doing for the next several years. And we were the only place you could really get this kind of, at least on the radio, which was still a dominant form of media at the time, where you could get an analysis that's trying to say, here's why 9/11 probably happened. We should probably consider our own role in the world and how we treat the world. Here's what's happening. We have civil rights right now being violated by Muslims in this country. We were doing shows about the internment of Japanese Americans from the 1940s to make sure that we weren't forgetting some of this history,
right?
You know? And we were really the one place that was critical of the reasons to invade Iraq 2 years later, or less than 2 years later, because it was early 2000, and about a year and a half later,
it was a long build up and debate, public, you know, and quote unquote debate, because it really just seemed like a lot of mainstream media was helping to make the case for starting the war, not helping to air both sides of a debate.
Today, Barbara Lee is enshrined in history as a hero, as being the one person to vote against the authorization for the use of military force in the war on terrorism in 2001. That happened on September 18th, just several days after the attacks happened. Today, she is widely, you know, lionized for that act. But at that time, she was largely condemned for that act. I remember a politician who got some standing here. It was a Green Party member at one time, Audie Bach, who you think would have been supportive of Barbara Lee. But after Barbara Lee did that one no vote, urging people to be cautious, Audie Bach challenged her in the next year's primary, in the 2002 primary. There was only one place, but there was one place Barbara Lee had to go, where she could go, where she did get a fair hearing,
right?
And that was KPFA. And we formed a very close relationship during those years with Barbara Lee. We had events with Barbara Lee during this period of time. The slogan, Barbara Lee Speaks for Me, is very much related to this. And Barbara Lee still gets the attention. We remember her for that. But I fear, as we're marking the 20th anniversary of KPFA, that KPFA is actually not getting the credit it should get 20 years after for its role that it played in the war on terrorism. And Eric, it was remarkable because this goes all the way up into the Iraq War, in the years past the Iraq War. Listeners responded. It was amazing. We would have fund drives really starting from 9/11 on. I don't think we were in fund drive on 9/11. We weren't. But after every fund drive we would have after September 11, 2001, every fund drive we would have after that, we made a lot of money.
Right.
People were donating like crazy. We would make, you have to check the books to fact check this, but I think we were making like $1 million in a week in a fund drive, which was unheard of. It's still unheard of. But for a few years there, every time we asked for money, those phones, you would be a phone room volunteer taking these pledges. As soon as you would, there would be 12 people in the room. As soon as you'd put the phone down, it would ring and you have to pick it right back up to do it again. And that would go on for a whole day.
Yeah.
And if you're familiar with fund drives, that's amazing.
a time that we may never return to. And again,
that was incredible. I remember I would go cover the Iraq War happens. I get my first paid gig with KPFA in 2002 as a Sacramento state legislative correspondent. This is what Christopher Martinez has done now ever since I left in 2003. He's still there doing it. So he's approaching 20 years.
Such a valuable reporting job in California because, you know, California, a nation unto itself, a very important place. And the state capital is not very well covered by local media, by statewide media, especially during the span of years that we're talking about.
Oh, it still is. And as somebody who has covered the state capital in California, Sacramento, and the federal capital in Washington, D.C., I would argue what happens at the state capital is far more impactful on your daily lives than what happens in Washington, right. D.C.
And the number
which may sound wild because right. all the attention is in Washington, D.C. But the reality is if you talk about the parameters of Medicaid and if you're going to get dental or the ability for undocumented immigrants to get a driver's license or, you know, how benefits are going to, some of the money for benefits comes from the federal government, but it's the states that set up the parameters.
Right.
And
right.
so it's really what happens at the state level that will affect people's daily lives much more than anything that happens in Washington, D.C. Nonetheless, all the attention is on Washington, D.C. But when the Iraq War happened in 2003, I was reassigned from the Capitol in Sacramento and told to cover the street protest in San Francisco. And what was really remarkable in these street protests in San Francisco is they literally shut San Francisco down for 4 days.
I
think this is another story that kind of gets lost. But there was nothing, especially in the financial district of San Francisco. It was, and that was a slogan, no business as usual while we're at war. We all remembered the Gulf War in 1991. And, you know, it became a TV event and it was like watching a movie and life went on as though there wasn't a war at all other than your entertainment on TV. Well, part of the idea with shutting down San Francisco was no business as usual. And for 4 days, that's exactly what happened. And KPFA played a huge role in that. I remember getting there early, going to Justin Herman Plaza down by the Embarcadero, a big plaza for people who aren't familiar with it, going down there because that's where protesters were first going to meet. And the protests would spread all over the city. But that's where they would first meet. And I'd be doing a live spot for the morning show with Andrea Lewis and Philip Maldery. And as I'm talking to them, I can hear my voice echoing throughout the entire plaza through different radios because so many people there were actually listening to KPFA while they were there. I remember going to, I remember doing a live spot in the middle of the day when I got word that protests were going to regather at Montgomery and Market. And I reported that on the radio. Within a half hour, people started showing up. Throngs of people started showing up. And I even asked them, like, how'd you all know this was happening? Like, oh, I heard it on the radio. Like, wow.
Right.
That's really cool. I remember I had another gig. I was driving down to San Jose. I wasn't driving, but a friend was driving down to San Jose. And there were people protesting on a highway overpass against the war. And one of their big banners that they furled, that they let down said, listen to 94.1 KPFA. It was an amazing period of time that I think, you know, when I explain all this, I think this was a real golden era for, and I keep saying KPFA, but I think it's correct to say Pacifica at large, community radio at large.
Yeah.
This was a golden era for Democracy Now, which of course airs at KPFA, but is not a KPFA product. And then when I went to Washington, D.C., in 2003, a couple of months later, this was before people's opinion about the war changed. This was before the insurgency in Iraq really took hold. And there was no one there other than us and our small bureau that we created at the Capitol that was going around and asking about, well, where are the weapons of mass destruction? Wait a minute, we were lied to. Weren't we lied to getting into this war? What about enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay? We were the only ones going up to John McCain asking him, hey, as a former prisoner of war? Are you not concerned about holding detainees at Guantanamo Bay outside extrajudicially, outside of the law, outside of the Geneva Conventions that we are a part of? And he would yell at me, right? He was not happy to hear those questions.
Right.
But we were it. We were the only, I mean, that would change. The insurgency started to happen. The Iraq War turned ugly. People got tired of the war in Afghanistan. And I don't mean to say that there weren't other people critical of these wars. There were. One of the biggest global demonstrations ever happened in the lead up to the war in Iraq. But not the media. You remember, Eric, all the TV newscasters had their American flag lapel pin on their coats. You know, there was just this fever of patriotism that really struck this country, I would say, between 2001 and 2005. And there was one place that didn't fall into that. There was one place like, this is crazy, and we're acting like we're crazy. And that was KPFA and Pacifica Radio at large. And for me, this will always be a golden era in community radio.
I'm glad you've said these things. We're wrapping up our time for the radio audience, but I'm going to ask you a lot more questions on the podcast coming up, which you can get online at radiosurvivor.com as we continue to talk, Mitch Jezerich, about your time producing community radio. You've told us a tale today where the beginnings of your time at the radio station KPFA as a volunteer were centered in your memory around the day that the September 11th attacks occurred and your decision to devote your professional energies, even as a volunteer. You know, you made this choice to go to work as a radio journalist, where you did the work of, you know, first reporting are rumors true, which is such a valuable thing for a journalist to do, to pick up the phone and verify that the things they're hearing are true or false, and then report that information to the audience as soon as it's been clarified, not prior to that, but not getting the order mixed up, which is so important and one of the primary jobs of someone who has the privilege to be on the microphones of radio stations, is not to speculate into microphones wildly when things are at stake. Up until interviewing vulnerable communities on the very first day, how are you doing? What threats are you receiving? What can people do to help? And what comes next? My thanks to Mitch Jezerich, who was the former Capitol Hill correspondent at Pacifica Radio, who covered the news daily for Free Speech Radio News from Capitol Hill. Mitch currently produces a news and public affairs radio program called Letters in Politics, which airs on Pacifica Radio Station KPFA. And you can also find Letters in Politics on YouTube. During the pandemic, Mitch has been posting episodes up on YouTube, and I highly recommend them. Very, very deep dives into fascinating historical topics from a perspective that I find very valuable, looking at history from a direction that is uncommon with real historians and real academic experts. Well, this has been Radio Survivor. My name is Eric Klein. The podcast version is a half an hour longer than this one you heard on the radio. You can tune into it anywhere where you get your podcasts. It's called Radio Survivor. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.